Welcome to Primary Election Night 2026. I'm Richard Nelson, founder and executive director of the Commonwealth Policy Center, coming at you live from the CPC studio. And I'm joined by my colleague and friend, Mike Harmon, former state auditor and state legislator. And we're going to unpack the election results and talk about CPC's involvement and a number of other things tonight.
All those great things. I always feel like, the president's really big into wrestling. I feel like we should say, let's get ready to rumble.
There you go.
But apparently the rumble's already over. Now we're just waiting for the judges.
You joke about that, but yes. I understand that for America's 250th birthday,
yes,
there's going to be MMA cage fighting somewhere in the vicinity of the White House.
Exactly.
Or somewhere
exactly.
in D.C. I think it's going to be
maybe
the
you
White
and
House,
I so. Should go up there and volunteer for just a little bit.
I would be willing to do that,
yes,
if there was some kind of CPC fundraising effort involved. Other than that, I don't know if I would.
We should call the president. Okay. Maybe not. Maybe not.
I'll put that on your to-do list.
I'll put that on my to-do list. All right.
Very good. Well, Mike, it is good to have you join
good
us.
And
we do have a lot to talk about on this May 19th election eve as the results are coming in. One of the first things I want to talk about is Commonwealth Policy Center's election resources and the work that we do with the candidates, where we send out questionnaires and we interview them. And of course, you spearheaded that.
Yes,
you were
yes.
the tip of the spear and you led the election resource effort. And we've talked about it before, but why don't you, if you could,
sure,
just refresh the for those who are not familiar with that.
Well, there's two things that we do. We send out a little bit earlier our AIP, our agreement in principle. And that just talks about our four foundations. It's just a long paragraph statement of what we believe, that God is number one in our life, that the family is the very important. They're pro-life. As a matter of fact, let me just read.
Why don't you do that? That'd be really helpful.
Then we'll
talk about why this is important.
So it says, all rights come from God, including the right of life, conscience, and religious freedom. Male and female identity is defined at conception by God, who is also the author of marriage between one man and one woman. From this union springs children, family, and the first economic union, the building block of society. Since God endows us with rights, it is the duty of government to protect such rights, institutions, and fiscal integrity so human beings can live out their calling.
Mike, thank you for reading that.
It's a very good statement.
It's a statement. As I had a conversation earlier today with a friend and somebody just getting to know us a little bit better. And this is where there's an intersection of theology mm-hmm. and the public arena, where there are some creational truths, like why yeah. are human beings valuable? Well, because we're made in the image of God. Who defines male and female? It's our creator. Where does the idea of marriage come from and how is it defined? Well, it's from God. But then also the idea that the purpose of government is to protect and secure our inalienable rights, that comes from the Declaration of Independence, right? That we're made and we're endowed by our creator with certain inalienable rights. And among these are life, right? A creational
yes,
ordinance,
yes.
liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Yes.
And that's something our founding fathers understood,
right,
where theology or biblical truths informed public life and politics.
And of course, I know you always say that, most people say you're not supposed to talk about religion or politics in mixed company, but we do both.
We do both.
Yes.
We? But we do it in a way I think that's responsible, and we're going to get back to the candidates
yes.
Outreach project that we had. But it's in a way that we believe that there are moral absolutes, that
right.
God defines reality, male and female and
yes.
marriage. And part of this discussion, though, is the church. Christians who are living according to the faith, of course, they're trying to live their lives and raise their families,
right.
families according to the faith. But also they take their biblical values with them when they go to the voting booth as well.
Oh, definitely.
Right?
When
the legislature's in session, they will call or they will lobby based on those biblical truths. And you could say that we are lobbyists, if you will, for the conservative cause, for the conservative Christian community, but really trying to work for those truths and then to do it in a careful, thoughtful way. This is a long way of addressing where separation of church and state or religion and politics, as you were saying, we don't talk about them in polite company. Well, we do.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because it's important. It's important that we get it right.
And we do more than lobby. We do the trainings, and we thought we did quite a few of those. You moderated several of the forums so that the public can know where these candidates stand.
One of the things that you did is you led Commonwealth Policy Center's election resource effort. You talked about sending out the agreement in principle.
And then you worked together to develop the questions, and we sent out questions.
So the questionnaire went out to tell us about how many people that those resources went out to, candidates.
Sure, sure. Well, in the primary, you know, for the State House and the State Senate, I think there was five Republican primaries. And then I think, if I remember correctly, I think in the House there was about 20 Republican primaries. So we sent those out. We also sent out a slightly different questionnaire, but we also sent out questionnaires to our Senate candidates and our federal Senate candidates, as well as all the congressional candidates. And so it was really good. I mean, we had a very good turnout, where sometimes you have to prod them, but we had a very good turnout of people that responded, both signing the AIP, agreeing to the principles that we talked about, as well as, you know, submitting the questionnaires. And so it was really good.
It was a good response rate. It created a good resource, which is posted on our website, by the way. If you go to commonwealthpolicycenter.org, you can find our candidate comparisons.
Yes.
You'll also find links to the candidate forums that both Mike and I had moderated. But tell us about those interviews.
The interviews went really well. We talked a lot of things. As a matter of fact, some of the interviews we did even before we did the questionnaires, because one of the things we wanted to do, since this applied to, you know, the State House and the State Senate, they were in session this year, so we wanted to make sure we wait till, I don't say the last minute, but, you know, close to it, so we could see if there was any issues that were relevant in the State House and the State Senate that we would want to address in the questionnaire. And the other thing we talked about, we did send out questionnaires. Now, the questions that we put on the candidate comparisons we actually post in mail, they're kind of a distilled version of that, just because we couldn't put every single thing on, whether it was online. But the other thing we do, it wasn't just based on the questionnaire, and it wasn't just based on the whether they signed the agreement in principle. We also, if they had a voting record, we tried to look at the voting record as possible. If we had a situation where one of our congressional candidates participated in a candidate forum, and we were able to see some of the issues that were involved with that and put that, you know, in the candidate comparison that we put out as well. So there's a lot of things that went into it.
So a lot of different ways that candidates responded.
Yes.
And different ways that we got to know the candidates. And this just so you're aware, there's a lot of work, is what we're saying here. There's a lot of work to set up the interviews, to send out the questionnaires, to prod them.
Then
the response.
Please send that in, or we'll have to put no response.
And then the layout. You know that the whole CPC team came together to do various aspects of this, but even putting together the final comparison using Adobe and doing the layout, which it turned out well. It was a good
resource. That wasn't you or I that did the layout.
So it's the younger people.
The younger people that know how to get around things.
That's right. But again, we do have those resources on the CPC website. Yeah. Go to commonwealthpolicycenter.org, and you can find out more about the candidates through their questionnaires and the comparison, and then also the forums as well. Mike, I want to move into another segment here about candidate qualities. Yeah. What makes a good candidate? What do we look for at CPC in a good candidate? And I want to go back to your experience running for the State House. You were involved with a number of races there, and then also state auditor. And share some of your observations of good qualities and then maybe not so good qualities.
Right.
Let's start with the good.
Well,
what were some of the qualities you saw either in yourself or in other people that you learned along the way?
I think both for the State House and then for when I was auditor. Of course, I ran and lost the first two times I ran for the House. But when I won, I ended up going to Washington, D.C., and God kind of laid on my heart kind of a mission statement. This is kind of how I look at candidates. Well, you know, and my mission statement was, I have no desire to leave a legacy except that I serve my Lord, I serve my family, and I serve my country well. And so that's kind of what you look at a candidate. First of all, you want to know, you know, if they love the Lord, you know, if they have a biblical worldview, that's important to me. And then we want to see how they treat their family. And then, you know, lastly, you know, we want somebody that loves this country. And, you know, and it should be in that order. I mean, I think I told you the story the last time that long before I got involved with politics, I was living in Lexington. My wife and I were living in Lexington. And while I was at work, a pastor stopped by, and he was running for some office. I don't even remember what it was. He asked my wife if he could put up a sign. He said, well, you know, my husband's kind of particular. And so, why don't you leave your sign, leave your number, and I'll have him call you. And if he agrees with your beliefs, then we'll go ahead and do it. So I did, and I called him, and, you know, and one of the things so near and to me, dear to me, and one of the main things that got me involved was the pro-life issue. And so I said, you know, what do you think about the pro-life issue? You know, an innocent unborn. He's like, well, and this was a pastor. And he was like, well, I think that's between, you know, a woman and her doctor and her God. And I was like, well, you know, I appreciate your time, but sorry, come get your sign. It's not going to go. So we have to be careful because just because someone has a label across their face, whether it's pastor or whether it's, you know, whatever, we need to dig deeper to make sure that they have the same qualities and the characteristics that we want. Now, if you got two candidates and neither one of them has all the qualities you want, then you got to look and see, you know, what's the best quality, or as I did sometimes, you just have to run, you know, so.
Yeah, and that's what you did.
Yeah.
But how about the approach? There's the one thing to have a principle, one thing to say, I believe in this.
Right.
I believe in that. And maybe they line up with us, but does that necessarily guarantee that CPC could get behind these people?
It doesn't necessarily guarantee, because there are some things, you know, we have certain core beliefs as well.
Yeah.
And if there's one or the other that is, you know, off or whatever, you know, we may like them. We may even, you know, wish them well, but sometimes if they don't line up, you know, we just, you know, of course we don't endorse in the primary anyway. We talked about that, but then in the general, we do look more.
Thank you for mentioning that. That is important that people know that we provide resources in the primary.
Yes.
The comparison, the forums, the other things. We've done the interviews and the vetting. And of course we have our own opinions as to who we think would be the better candidate.
Yes.
But we don't do endorsements. What I was getting to though, as far as other things to look at. So for example, Mike, if somebody lined up with CPC or the conservative community in general on all of the issues, if they held all of the right positions on the issues, but if that candidate came out of the gate with a smear campaign, or if they're making up falsehoods or slandering or not conducting themselves well, which happens from time to time.
Yes.
But we wouldn't get involved with something like that.
Yeah, we wouldn't get involved with a smear campaign.
Yeah. No. Yeah. It is important to us, and I'm pressing on that because it is so important to us that candidates conduct themselves with integrity, that they engage the conversations with respect. They can be firm on their principles and push forward a firm argument, but there are certain lines that we expect them not to cross when it comes to engaging.
And we hold ourselves to that same accountability because, you know, we don't want our candidate comparison ever to be looked at as a smear or whatever, because that's why we make sure we give them every opportunity to fill out the questionnaire, every opportunity to sign the AAP, every opportunity to interview and explain if there is some variance. And then we just report what they have said, either in public or
Mike, in the questionnaires. Now, Mike, there are a number of groups involved tonight. I want to move to the next segment, and we're going to talk about the different organizations. Now, in the last, since 2010, so 16 years, 2010 was the Citizens United ruling, which allowed the rise of the super PACs. So we see many of these independent expenditure PACs. They're not authorized by any candidate or campaign. These PACs are allowed to raise money from corporations or individuals where there's unlimited funding, unlimited donations, where the names of the donors are shielded, and really a lot of money can be poured into a campaign. Many of these PACs are run negative campaigns. Some are positive. They can be positives. One of the candidates that they're getting behind is Kim Banta. I saw one of the mailers that they helped to fund. And they tend to get behind candidates who are not social conservatives. Kim Banta, I think, is a fiscal conservative. She's for education reform and accountability. But they, in particular, this election and then last election, they got behind a number of moderate candidates. And I think that's one thing that we'll look at tonight is their involvement and what kind of impact they have on the races that they engage. The other thing I mentioned, Kentucky Right to Life endorsements, they did endorse in ways that maybe was a surprise to some.
Right.
Daniel Cameron for the U.S. Senate was endorsed by them. Andy Barr was recommended. But then there were some House and Senate races where they either didn't mention candidates or they didn't endorse, and it was in rubric. So we'll take a look at that tonight as well to see how those endorsements fared. And then I mentioned Americans for Prosperity. They are doing door-to-door campaigning across the state also. Here's from your experience, Mike, this is the question. What kind of impact do outside groups have, let's say a state house race? Sure. That's what you've got experience with.
Yeah, that and the altar's race. But mm-hmm. from the standpoint of outside groups, you know, I always said, for me personally, I always said, if you don't go negative, or your associates or affiliates or people that are affiliating themselves with you don't go negative, then I won't go negative. And even if you do, I'm always a little bit cautious on the type neg. You never want to get into anything personal. It's just, if you go negative, it's something they've said or something, you know, they did politically or, you know. Yeah, I had one time somebody, a fellow was running against me. He had never served, and they had a postcard they sent to my mom, and I think I may have got it too, but it had me all F's. And then had my opponent, who had never served, all A's. And my mom just said, well, that just means it's fine and dandy. And sometimes the negative will work. A lot of times, especially if it's dumped right on the end, tends to backfire, you know, with my personal experience. Like the experience when I was auditor, of course, this was my opponent's own ad that had me in a private jet and flying around and everything and accusing me of all sorts of stuff. But they made the mistake of having a pretty flight attendant serve me an alcoholic beverage. And of course, I was a teetotaler and everybody knew it. So it made my Republican, and I had a lot of Democrat friends too, so it made them mad, but also elevated my name, because a lot of people saw it. Most people knew it was a hit piece, but a lot of people saw it and they were like, hey, Mike, saw your ad, looked real good, you know.
Well, and we often do see where negative advertising can backfire.
Right.
Where when people know the character of a candidate, when they know that person personally, or they just know their reputation and say, this is ridiculous, the person who's running the negative ad, they're the ones that lose believability. They're the ones that are going to really repel voters. Yeah. And you saw that happen up close and personal
with
the auditor's race. And you won by a pretty good margin with a very small amount of money, which that's the next thing I want to go to. How much impact does money have in an election?
In a primary, probably a whole lot, because the joke I always said, I ran 25 years in a row, served 21 years in a row, but never won a Republican primary. But in a general election, you know, because really most of the races I ran for is like, hey, Richard, you want to run? No, I don't run. You want to run? I don't run. Let's go get Mikey. He'll run. But, you know, God was with us and we had some good victories. But it's one of those things where you need money to get your message out.
Yeah.
But if you don't have a ton of money, then you just got to work your butt off and get out there and talk to as many people as you can and do as much. And sometimes when you get that synergy, especially in a general election, when the oceans are moving your way, when it comes to, you know, Republicans are doing better, sometimes you can catch the wave. But now in that same race that I won in 2015, where I had 45,000 going up against the incumbent, Adam Edlin, who had 800,000 and still was able to win, God bless us. You also had a situation where Whitney Westerfeld was running for attorney general, and he lost by
2,000
votes, give or take. And so, and that, you know, politics is a game of inches. I mean, if you think about if Whitney had won that particular race, then, you know, Andy Beshear would have never been attorney general. If he had never been attorney general, would he had still been as likely to run and win governor? You never know.
That's a good point. So money is important to get out your message, but it's not everything. I'm reminded of several Republican primaries last election in 2024, where whole bunches of money was raised towards moderate Republicans to unseat conservative incumbents. And in one case, for example, Mike, there was a incumbent Republican who had about $400,000. The person who beat him had $40,000.
Yep.
It was a 10-to-1 fundraising advantage.
Yep.
And the conservative candidate that had a small amount of money comparatively actually won by a 72% to 26% margin, something like that. So money is not everything. You need to be right on the issues.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be right with your constituency. Are you in line with where your constituents are? Are you a person of integrity? So very good. Mike, do you have any predictions? We're going to pivot over to election returns.
Yes.
We've got them coming in. Do you have any? Actually, before we go into the projections, Donald Trump endorsed a number of candidates. He endorsed Thomas Massie, congressman of the 4th District, that's Northern Kentucky, introduced his opponent. He also introduced Andy Barr, and those were two of the major endorsements, and then Ralph Alvarado. Those were three endorsements that I'm aware of in Kentucky.
Now he endorsed some more, but those are the ones, because, you know, he went ahead and endorsed Comer, James Comer.
Okay,
first.
He did.
Yeah, he did. And Hal Rogers endorsed Hal Rogers and Brett Guthrie. But those were pretty solid solid or safe seats for the most part. You know, I think from everything that we can see, more than likely that Andy Barr will win. As a matter of fact, as I'm looking right now, it looks like they've already projected Andy Barr to win for the Senate seat. Haven't looked at just yet. I think from the standpoint, before I even look at the vote totals, I would say that the 4th District with Thomas Massie is probably very close, but we'll just scroll down here and take a little look. And it looks as if, let's see here, right now it looks as if Ed Gowron is ahead 57-43 with about 13.3% of the vote. So depending on where that vote has come in from, could be, you know, a big difference, because some of the articles that we've seen, you know, Boone County, very supportive, or a lot of energy in Boone County for Massie. Some of the other counties in there, maybe not as much.
Yeah, that'll be a fascinating race to watch. Yes. It's not just the whole country, but internationally. The international community is watching the Thomas Massie, Ed Gowron race, because it answers the question, or many people are looking at it through the prism of, can a Republican congressman stand up and vote against the president, right, and still maintain their seat?
Yeah.
And of course, it looks like it is, as far as primary congressional spending, it looks like a record high. It's $35 million, I believe was the number that I heard early. $35 million just spent on a primary. So much of it was spent against Thomas Massie.
Yes.
So we will see how that pans out. It looks like it might be a long night until we get all those numbers.
It could be a long night, especially since all those are tied. But now, I do think it's interesting, of course, and I think they're just looking at the trend. And we've talked about this before. It's hard on me because I have so many of my friends running against each other in all these races. I know Daniel Cameron very well. I know Andy Barr very well, consider both of them friends. In that 6th congressional seat that we talked about, know Ryan Dotson, and I've known Ralph and his wife for a long, long time, consider, you know, both of them friends. So it's tough. And of course, Massie, I jokingly said, for all transparency, when I ran that race for auditor and only had 45,000, Thomas Massie was 1,000 of that 45,000. So for full transparency there. But
there you go. So, Mike, the question tonight is, will Trump's endorsement have an impact on these races? We did see where in Louisiana, where Donald Trump endorsed against a sitting U.S. Yep. His name just escaped me.
Yes.
But he lost in the primary just the other day. It wasn't Kennedy. It was Cassidy. Thank you.
Yes.
It
yes.
was Senator Cassidy from Louisiana, and he lost. He ran a distant third.
Yes.
In that.
Perhaps, he wanted to be part of the runoff, because I think they went to a runoff.
That's so, right. It's the top two vote getters in that.
If they don't get 50%.
That is correct. Yeah. That's right. So we will see. We will see that, along with the money game. Much of this has to be done post-election when all the final finance reports come in, and we'll look at the endorsements, which we're aware of some now, but it will be fascinating to see how things shape up. So, Mike, I'm going to look at we're going to go into the returns.
Yes.
And we've got a couple of different resources here, right, but I'm looking at the WDRB Louisville. This is the Fox affiliate in Louisville.
Yes.
And they are giving returns for the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate. Amy McGrath is in the lead right now.
Which was a bit surprising based on the
polling. This is a bit surprising. She's over Charles Booker, 42.9% to 38.1%. But this is only 9% of the votes counted. Charles Booker was way ahead in the polling,
right,
as of even a week ago.
Yeah,
he was way ahead. Now, Charles Booker is a former state representative. He campaigns on the far left.
Yes.
Universal health care.
I think he said from the hood to the holler. Wasn't that his kind of his saying?
I think when he ran against, was it Rand Paul?
I think maybe, yeah.
He ran again for this position before, but from the hood to the holler.
Yes.
You're right.
Yeah.
But he's a very gifted speaker, very passionate, and he does connect with the far left of the Democratic Party.
And to be honest with you, he's a very likable individual. Now, I don't agree with his politics, this guest, but he's a very likable individual.
Now, he was projected to win that. We will see if the numbers come up. You know, I think it depends on where these numbers are coming from.
Right.
If it's from far eastern Kentucky, the numbers are probably not going to favor him. But when Louisville shows up to vote, Charles Booker is one of the favored sons there.
Oh, very much so.
Where he will carry that Blue City Democratic vote.
It would be very surprising if he did not.
Pam Stevenson is a state house member. She is running a distant third with 6%. of the vote. It's interesting because she was the first person to announce that she was going to run for U.S. Senate. And then eventually Charles Booker and Amy McGrath got in. Stay tuned with that. With the Kentucky primary for U.S. Senate, Andy Barr is up 61.1% to Daniel Cameron's 30.8%. And WDRB, this is only 14% of the votes counted, and it looks like they're already calling Andy Barr. It seems to me a little early, but who knows? Only 14% have of the votes have come in.
And things can change, but, you know, with 14.4%, it does look like if the trend holds up, he'll not only win, but win big.
Yeah. If that's the case, that's about a 2-to-1, 2-to-1 margin. And something would have to happen. I think I'll add one thing for the U.S. Senate race. Daniel Cameron appears to be very strong in Western Kentucky.
Yes.
And those numbers won't come in for a while yet. It's still only 7:30, so 6:30. The polls had just closed in Western Kentucky.
And if anybody's in line, it takes a while to tabulate it. But also, if there's anybody in line, although turnout seemed to be a little low, if they're in line at 7, they can still vote.
Mike, talk about the turnout since you brought that up.
Yeah, I don't know what has happened so far today, but I know Secretary Michael Adams, based on the absentee ballot, has forecast that there'll be about a 20% turnout, which is actually a lot better than when I ran for governor, which there was only 13% of registered Republicans, but which was kind of sad. I think there might have been just a hair more, but not many more of the Democrats.
So but there is a difference between constitutional office election years, their off-year elections, and the midterms. Yeah. Midterms generally will have more voter turnout because you've got more people on the ballot from city and county. Every county level race is on the ballot.
But it's also every presidential year. In the presidential year, you'll have almost double
that's right
turnout.
So presidential year, you'll have high voter turnout. Midterm, second highest. And then the off-year elections, especially during the primary, being the governor's race and Secretary of State and Attorney General, all those, you'd mentioned just 13%, and that was back in 2023. Yeah. So very, very low turnout. And friends, many of the elections are being determined in these primaries. Right now, we've got a number of Republicans on the ballot for State House who, if they win their primary, they're going to go into, they will win office. Because there's not a Democratic challenger. Same on the Democratic side, by the way. There are several Democrats, especially in the blue cities in particular. Whoever wins that Democratic primary will move on to become the next state representative.
Yeah, I think.
Or state senator.
For state senator, I think after this, there is only, I think there's only 10 general election races for the Senate, and there is 49 for House. So basically, you'll only have 59 primaries for the State House and the State Senate together, whereas you've got 100 total state representatives and, I guess, half of the 38, which would be 19. So you've got 119 opportunities, but there are only actually 59 races in the fall.